Hi, everybody. You're listening to Bushwick Junction on Radio Free Brooklyn. Bushwick Junction is a show hosted by me, Asha Saluja, about life's inflection points. It's about the crossroads in our lives, which paths we choose when we reach them, and where those choices lead us or don't. We'll talk about the decisions we agonized over and the decisions we didn't even realize we were making until years after we made them. We'll talk about how we decide things, how we weigh our options, or how we tap into our intuitions. And we'll talk about the degree to which our choices matter. Do we have any control over the things that alter our fate, or do we end up in the same place no matter which roads we take? On each show, I have a new guest tell me about all the big decisions they've ever made in order. We start with birth, fast forward to their first big decision, and map out the road their life has taken as a series of these inflection points or junctions. With that, I will introduce today's very special guest who has promised you, listener, the music of the universe, so I hope he delivers. Christian Larson Sakaris is a social entrepreneur and software developer living here in Brooklyn in the most interesting residential space I've ever seen in my 27 years on this planet Earth. Christian, hi.
Hello.
Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
So the first question on this show, and you know, one that you can skip if you don't feel like talking about it, is tell me about the circumstances into which you were born.
Two young parents by today's standards, mid-early 20s in the middle 70s, with no money, on Medicaid, smart people, not educated, who then ended up working a whole lot and moving to a school system that was good, a good public school system, got a good education and the privilege that comes with that, and just have been, you know, kind of grounded in that, but not tethered to it so much.
So we're thanking the public school system. Public resources don't get enough of a shout out this day and age. Where was that? Where did you?
That was in upstate New York.
Gotcha. So
actual upstate, you know, upstate.
Right. I'm not local enough to hear to have these political like quandaries about what's considered upstate.
Yeah.
Do you want to give a city shout out?
Albany.
Albany. Gotcha. Yeah.
So
we're thanking the public school system in the Albany.
No, we're not actually. Oh. I grew up in the suburbs outside. The Albany schools are terrible, and I had to flee them for the good schools in the suburbs, sadly.
All right. So we're thanking the larger metropolitan area of Albany's state school system. We're thinking about education and the role it played. That was a really, really concise answer to that question. Kudos. So tell me about the first big decision you ever made.
The first big one was to drop out of college after like a year and a half, 2 years. And yes, that can be like a fuzzy number in somebody's life. It was a process. But and then work and try to figure out what I wanted to do with my life, because I had been on the road to being an academic since I was in high school.
Interesting.
It's like, Christian's going to be a scholar. So
did you want to be what's the first thing you remember wanting to be? Was it that?
Yes.
A professor specifically, sort of like someone who lives in academia, does research, and teaches also.
Yeah. I mean, like being somewhere in like a research institute where I didn't have to teach actually was kind of my first dream job.
What was your subject area of interest?
Evolution and the foundations of biology.
Wow. So tell me how did that take root?
Wanting to know how the world worked and looking around at it and seeing that, you know, we're part of this large biological system. And at the time, you know, people really, it's hard to kind of describe how quickly I think, and probably like climate change and stuff like that has precipitated this, how quickly people have gone to this feeling that like we're really inherent with nature, even in like mainstream Western thought. But I found in academic stuff in the time in the 80s, the late 80s and early 90s, there was really this kind of like biology is like plants and animals. And that's what the domain that it has to like offer explanations in. And then there's like economics and stuff like that. And it was really the only the leading thinkers who were very fringe, like the people at the Santa Fe Institute in particular, who are really saying like, no, these are like systems, you know, we're all part of these same systems and there's got to be ways that they all, you know, exhibit the same behaviors and they're operate under similar laws and, you know, trying to like draw that line between biology and physics and sociology.
Yeah, my brain went exactly there. It was funny that you you followed, you like beat me there. But yeah, so to be sort of a kid, a teenager, and say, I want to know how the world works, and to have the next step be, well, I want to be a research biologist. Me being outside,
I wanted to be a theoretical biologist, actually. It's something that there's very few people. There's very few of those jobs. You got to be really committed to get one of those jobs.
So let's talk about your level of commitment.
So I wasn't committed to academia. That was clear. I got into it, you know, by entering college. Like, and I had some exposure beforehand, but, you know, being immersed in it in college and seeing that my favorite professors were kind of miserable. And, you know, amazing people doing amazing work and just beaten down by the system and the hours, and weren't enjoying their lives and weren't feeling, I don't think, like they had an impact, except outside the classroom and there, you know, to like the field and to their students. But it was a very insular sort of thing. And I just felt like I have to be out in the world and doing stuff.
I'm curious. I'm not going to challenge you on that, but I'm curious. You just said like these professors weren't having an impact except in their field of research and to the people in their classroom. Like, were you expecting a more broad scope in that profession than you ended up seeing? Like, what's the most impact a professor...
Well, if it had been an easy road, then it would have been great, you know? But the trade-off was too much, I thought.
Interesting. In just terms of raw years, like you're studying for years and years before you can start to have an impact?
Yeah. It's a very long road. And it's just very abstract. And everyone in that environment, unless you can find a special place, and even the special places are hard to, you know, maintain this, is like drawing you away from that, right?
Makes sense.
You into the institution, into the like bubble.
Were you like a little
the
bit...
The siren call of the academic bubble.
It's not that tempting for most people. Not like a sexy sea lady or anything. What I'm curious, in that year, in that year and a half, what else did you start envisioning? Like, was there another siren call, or was it just a process of disillusionment with what you saw?
No, I just, it was kind of like a reset, you know, opportunity to be like, okay, that path isn't going to work. Is there a path that feels right? You know? And so I'd gone to school out west. I lived upstate. I went to school out west. I came back. I worked in a restaurant. I took classes. And I studied and made art a lot. And logic. I did a lot of work in logic.
The music, what?
No, like
like theoretical logic.
Yeah, like
what
deep into
the
like
even
nature
mean?
Of logical systems and how like what are all, you know, when you're talking about the properties of different like logical systems and stuff like that. The super abstract stuff. The stuff where you're getting a C and you're the other people in the class are asking you to tutor them.
Well,
and you're sitting down with the professor for an hour and they're like, you just have to think about it more. It's hard.
I want to skip back real quick. When we think about the disillusionment with what you saw, was any of it institution-based? Were you sort of...
Oh, it was all institution-based.
So do you think it would have... Were you turned off by institutions in general at that time in your life? Or were you disillusioned with the particular institution you ended up at?
I ended up at a great one, and I thought, well, if this is as good as it gets, then I don't want part of it.
That's so powerful. Like, if I'm at the best, if I'm in the best possible iteration of what I'm looking to do, and it's bad, you should probably do something.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me what it looks like to work on Logic. Like, what do you do? Like,
I don't know if you really want to go down that hole, but
can you do it in by 4:15?
I mean, yeah, it's just, you know, you start simple, and you know, with systems that describe little bits of things, right? So you have an intuitive sense of what logic is, right? You have an intuitive sense of negation. And I don't mean intuitive like it's coming out of your genes. I mean, like, you know, whatever imbues it with you, like we all kind of have it. And you have this sense that, like, two things can be correct or not, that there's truth values to things. These are very deeply intuitive things. And you just build off of that. But then when you start trying to build that into a formal structure, you know, problems start happening and things don't align right. And then it becomes a problem of, you try to think through how, you know, why that is and how you could change the systems and in order to create better ones and to understand how we cognate.
Just in practice, though, like, what is that?
It looks like math, but kind of simpler with, you know, it has a symbol system that goes around with it. And, you know, it looks like algebra.
How do you get started? Like, is there some body of work that you can, like, log into and then work from there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure online, because I learned it a long time ago. I haven't looked recently, but I'm sure, like, there's math. Like, you know, you can start from the basics, like addition and subtraction online with math. I'm sure there's, you can learn logic the same way. And it's easier to learn than a lot of math, I think.
Fascinating.
But it gets extremely abstract when you start trying to think about the nature of these things in a grand way. And it's just very hard to think about.
What kind of art were you making?
Mostly sculpture, drawing. Like, drawing was probably the hardest class I've ever taken cognitively. Oh. It hurt my brain. I have to take naps after I did drawing sessions.
I get that. I do.
But, sorry, repeat the question.
Just what kind of art were you making?
It was very tied in with kind of how I was thinking about the world at the time, which was like reading a lot about the systems thinkers who were important in the 90s and before. And I wanted to have objects that people experienced and had an experience with. I guess that was really like the foundation of what I was thinking about with art at the time, was how do you like bring that person in to the piece? How does it become a relationship? And sometimes in like very simple, quiet ways, and sometimes in more kind of traumatic, but never like theatric, but more, movement like through space and something's happening, and then sometimes maybe something you do repetitively or something you that only can be together when you hold it.
Were you experimenting medium wise? Like, were you getting futuristic or were you making sculpture and driven by those principles?
No, I wasn't getting futuristic. I didn't have it. First of all, the future wasn't there then. And
even future wasn't there then?
Yeah. And even,
I think you're mistaken.
Well, you know, 3D printing and stuff like that and like using computers to like drive.
Right. I understand.
Stuff really hadn't arrived. And so I was just fabricating what I needed to fabricate to make the things I was thinking about.
That's interesting. All art is about the experience that the beholder has. I think if you just put that front and center, you're probably going to be making better art.
Thank you.
So you're in this period where you're working for a paycheck and experimenting with things you love. And how does that period of your life end?
With the realization that, you know, whatever you're doing is, it's really based on like how well you understand the world, like how effective you can be, and that I wasn't really done with that path. So I went back to school.
Oh.
And tried to finish my degree, but because of like strange circumstances, ended up with a lot of credits.
And did you go back to the same school?
Yeah. So I had gone to SUNY Albany to do a bunch of requirements and do all this art stuff and a bunch of logic and some other stuff. I think I matriculated there for like a year. And then and took some and a bunch of other classes before. It was like 2.5 years, I think. And then when I went back, I had all those credits. And then when I went back, I finished my degree, but I had to write a thesis. And I had taken basically, and I'd also audited a bunch of classes when I left before. And I'd basically taken like every class that I wanted to take. And nobody was really going to help me with my thesis because it was weird. And it wasn't under anybody's research. It was just weird because I was doing a dual degree with philosophy and biology. And I wanted to look at what is function, like the definition of function in biology from a philosophical perspective. And the scoop was that if you weren't working on your advisor's research, like, you know, they kind of just read your drafts and wished you luck. And I had taken all the courses and I would have had to matriculate for a whole year to write my thesis. And even though it looks like a bargain price now, it's like hemorrhaging cash. So I was just like, okay, I'm just not going to graduate. So that was the second big decision there.
Okay. So you felt a little bit like you were flying under the faculty's radar. Like none of them were going to take you under their wing.
Liked me, but it didn't make sense. I mean, they would have had to learn a lot about what I was interested in just to like really be helpful. And it's not reasonable to expect.
Right. Can we contend with the fact for a second that like most people who are going to college, university, masters, whatever, are also hemorrhaging cash and sort of see some value in finishing, right?
Like, yeah, I mean, that's what everyone was telling me at the time, right? So like, you're an idiot.
How did you decide that you didn't need to do that?
Because I decided that really the only reason I was there was so that I could potentially go to grad school without a hassle. And that if I really wanted to go to grad school later in life, I could make it happen. Unless I had screwed my life up and was on the street or, you know, whatever.
Well, can you make it happen? Like, you can make that happen by going back to eventually finish school. So it was just like an hour later thing, right?
Yeah, if I really need it, I'll do it later.
Were you thinking in that time about your future profession and kind of making the call safely that it didn't require you to do this, the thing that most people do?
I had a deep sense that I wasn't going to follow some like path to, you know, I wasn't going to like go to grad school, get the PhD, you know, from a good program, have these like high power friends around me, get put into some institute. Like that just wasn't going to happen because I just didn't live my life in a way that was conducive to that. I was kind of a radical, you know, heretic kind of guy. And so it just didn't seem like that was... And I just didn't want to like press into the wheel hard enough to like make that kind of trajectory happen for the 6 years or so you have to do.
Where does your heresy come from?
Everyone's wrong about everything and they won't admit it.
What? I was thinking more like I had rebellious parents or like, I don't know, I had a really interesting older friend who told me to question it. Like,
no, we're just all idiots and we're just all like convinced we know how things are. And if you start from that premise, which I think is basically correct, you know, we're not smart beings generally. You know, we're like bumbling around, screwing up the planet, not responding to what's really happening. Head in clouds or in our little bubbles or whatever. We're not like geniuses. And but everyone's like, oh, this is how it is.
We're not geniuses compared to what?
Compared to like the possibilities of a species that really could do amazing things.
What possibilities?
Well,
how do we
like
know they're
trillions
real?
Of planets and you know, there's gotta be smart people somewhere.
What if we're
people
the smartest
who are actually
ones?
Right. Well, I mean, we show ourselves to be wrong so often.
You know,
we have so many cognitive biases, right? We're really adapted for small group living. You know, truth is like not a super big deal. Much more is cooperation and like a unity of belief and purpose. And so I just don't think we're there yet. You know, we're all gonna be wrong for a long time. Let's admit it.
Wow. That's so much to chew on. So I guess applying that to the premise of my show and we're making decisions where we're just fucking up all the time. Like,
well,
we're never going to do it right.
You can do it better or not, for sure.
Do you think that?
Oh, yeah. I labor over decisions.
Oh, tell me more. Like,
I just think about them. I just turn them in my head. I try to see how different thinking about different alternatives makes me feel.
You use feelings?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's what we're good at, right? Like, we're good at like creating this gestalt and intuitions about things.
Yeah.
It sucks, you know, when you're wrong, if that's what you're good at.
I was going to counter you when you said we're all bumbling idiots. I'm like, but maybe we're just really good at having feelings. Even just having our own feelings is a form of intelligence that we maybe are the best at in the whole universe.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
Probably not.
Okay.
I mean, that I think you can, we're good at wrapping a lot of information up at once. And having a kind of it's good, it's bad sort of response to it. We're really good at that. Most people just like don't try it, I don't think, and don't try to clear their head to do it.
So if I'm getting this right, I kind of want to like nail down your more elegant theory before we get to the big decision so we can play it out at every junction. But your like methodology is basically, I'm going to play out every scenario in my head, see how it makes me feel.
Well, and then also think about what the potential outcomes are and if it really makes sense, you know, given what I know that's possible and what the kind of percentages are.
So playing out to furthest possible.
Yeah, not like outcomes. A chess game, but more like, you know, is this path like, is this like an attractive thing to do, but kind of a dead end, you know, just trying to.
So is that something you are already doing intentionally at that junction, the not graduating one? Or is this something you've acquired a taste for over time?
I think I was doing it. I do it more. I wouldn't have been able to articulate it in the way I do now at
gotcha.
That point.
Do you think that we become less of bumbling idiots over the course of our life?
It all depends on the person.
Cool. Okay, so let's fast forward to a next big decision. Briefly tell us what happens after you make that decision.
I try to get a job as a environmentalist because I
How?
Am now
what? What
educated
does that mean?
As a biologist with like a specialty in ecology and evolution. And so there are policy shops, you know, that say this is what's happening in the environment and this is how we should respond to it.
Sort of like
advocate for that.
Science expert think tanks type of.
Yeah, like NRDC would be like probably the biggest national one that people would know. But I went back to upstate New York and I was there was like one in the state capital. And there probably still is. And God bless them for being there. But they didn't have a job for me. And what I realized by looking at a bunch of others was that there were very few jobs in that field, and the people that were getting them were people who had done internships and already had relationships. So it really didn't matter. So I just started kind of casting about for doing something that I liked. And I talked myself into a job at the Civil Liberties Union working in...
Say it again?
The New York Civil Liberties Union.
Oh,
so the
cool.
New York State affiliated.
CLU, yeah. Doing environmental work?
No.
Ooh.
They just do civil liberties stuff. And so I'd given up. I was like, basically, I'm not going to find one of those jobs. Unless at the time, I didn't want to move to a big city because I was going to be making so little and working for a nonprofit that I didn't want to live the lifestyle that would be required. Get some entry-level job at a nonprofit and live in New York or Boston or something. So I was going to like hide out for a little bit in a less expensive place. I talked my way into that job and I worked on civil rights and civil liberties. Ended up being for many, many years in different capacities.
So was it almost happenstantial? Like you're kind of.
Yeah, I mean, there were a limited probably number of issues that I or organizations that I would want to work for. And, but that was one of the issues. I mean, I didn't talk my way into a job by being like, I'm really cool. It was like, because I really understood the issues and I had a lot of passion for them. So,
did you have anything on paper that you, like, did you have any experience?
I studied a bunch of political science. That was really it.
Like, and this was entry level. It was at a place where you just had to be interested, basically.
In a way, but I mean, I think, you know, there were probably people with master's degrees that had applied for that job.
Gotcha. How did that go?
Really well. But under really hard circumstances. So, first of all, 9/11 happened, and the response from the government was not... the legal response, the legislative response was not well thought out, and was hysterical, basically. Mm. And you had a bunch of people who had been trying to create a whole bunch of changes in the New York State criminal justice system for many, many years, decades, who were like, oh, this is the time. And so we just fought against the tide of a lot of really terrible legislation and the kind of stuff where you see, and I think, you know, prosecutors have gotten ahead of this now and stuff. You don't see this much anymore, but, you know, like teenager on, you know, Twitter makes threat and is now a felon and stuff like that. You know, we saw all that coming and told people about it and were ringing the alarms and it didn't work. And then I worked also on a couple issues that are now popular, but at the time were very small, and we were also fighting against a tide that we couldn't stem, working on voting rights issues and criminal justice reform. So I beat my head against the wall for a lot of years, and, you know, just you can't do it forever.
Did you feel like you were on the same side as your organization on everything or most things? Or did you feel like it was you guys fighting the tide of
No, like, there were a lot of people. I mean, the Criminal Defense Bar in New York was really good on particular issues. The problem, the biggest problem is that you can get everybody on board on an issue, all sides to agree. And if the politicians have decided that politics dictates that we do A, B, or C, it's really not going to matter. And I worked on issues where the politics often dictated, and there were small groups of advocates and concerned citizens. And luckily, that's changed. But I think because those things were terrible, you know, 10 years ago, and are just gotten more terrible over time. Now people like talk about them all the time. But that was the frustration.
Wow. I feel like we could have a whole show about that. That's such a time and a place, really, of like you were centered in a crazy moment in human history.
Yeah, some good things did happen. I went on the first lobby visits in the state capitol here in New York for same-sex marriage, and that was the one big victory over that time. That I was already out by the time we won that, but if you had asked the people in whatever, 2004, know, how long is this going to take, and will the legislature pass it, or will it be the courts? You know, none of us would have said less than 10 years.
Wow.
And it was significantly less than 10 years. I mean, we're like 32% approval at that point or something like that. And even your friends are being like, you know, I can't say I support
six
this.
6 years? Was that 2011?
Something like that, yeah.
Gotcha. How did that end? Why did you stop?
I wanted to move. I had been in the Capitol for a long time, and I wanted to do other things, and there wasn't really a like obvious place up for me without getting a JD. So, which everyone advocated.
Why didn't you want to get a JD?
Oh, I hate the law. I mean, the law is like the worst literature ever written, right? Like,
right. I completely feel you, but also you'd been working in it.
Yeah. Well, that was the other thing. After all those years, I mean, do you want to learn court procedure and stuff like that? I know all the interesting stuff. I mean, I've done a lot of legal analysis. I can talk the Constitution as well as anybody. And so, you know, it's just, it would just be doing it to do it. And I had other options, so.
Which were?
Well, I had expertise, and I had worked through when the Help America Vote Act was passed, which was the bill that was the response to the Hanging Chads and the election in Florida and the first time, the winner lost. And so there was a big process to implement that in New York State, and I kind of by proximity and interest ended up leading the lobbying effort for the groups advocating around that for like pro-voter reform.
This is APA. Separately from your work with the CLU. This is
this was as a person at the CLU.
So and you were working, your capacity there was as a lobbyist, essentially.
Yeah. Where was I?
We were sort of talking about your way out of this life, but you were working on
my whole life is in my mind right now, and I'm like,
Bill.
So I gained some expertise because I was kind of the lead guy on this big voting reform package, which touched like kind of all the issues around voting reform, and then I had done the criminal justice work, so I got a job in the city working for a shop that did. Basically brought together progressive legislators at the state level around the country to try to do unified work around core progressive issues. And so they hired me to be the democracy and elections guy.
So this was right after. You were like...
There was some break. I spent the winter at Killington working on the mountain and snowboarding all the time. And I highly recommend that if you have a chance in your life to, and you'd like to do that sort of thing.
Be a ski bum.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the only way to be good unless you're rich and just can go all the time. That was fun. So I did that in between.
Did you quit the CLU without a next step, but knew that there would be sort of stuff brewing?
Yeah.
Cool. Was that a hard decision?
I had kind of been doing it. I wasn't doing lobbying anymore. I was doing policy analysis and writing reports and stuff like that. And, it was a process probably over a year.
Tell me about your decision to take this new job. What did you feel like you were accomplishing by doing that? Like, what boxes was it checking for you?
Even though I was like an only guy, it was like my thing, my program. I got to interact with everyone and make all the decisions and do all the writing.
You wanted to be in charge of something.
Yeah. And if it had worked out, then there was a chance that it could grow. I thought the organization was taking an interesting approach in the face of... not a lot of organizations taking interesting approaches. So
I want to take a step back or out, sort of. You talked about wanting to be a researcher or a theoretical biologist, and like you seem to have had a one-track mind toward that. And you didn't mention interest in social justice or activism or the law until we arrived at the point of you having that job. So can we trace back that thread a little bit farther? Like, where did this interest come from?
I mean, I was always interested in like the same sort of thing, like what makes the world the way it is, you know, what are the systems that control my life, the people around me.
And
the political and the economic systems are obviously central to that. So I had an interest in them.
Even though they're all biological.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Yeah, it's all ecology, right? And then in the end, it's all entropy.
Whoa, it's all entropy. What other things do you extend this to? So you're interested in the systems that control your life, and we start with entropy, and then we talk about ecology, and then we talk about socioeconomics. And I'm curious, what else, what other things, you actually said specifically, there are only a couple things I was interested in doing.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other ones? Were there in this time of your life?
Well, yeah. I interviewed for a job working with an arts organization. The Rockefeller Foundation, I think, had funded a thing called Leveraging Investments in Creativity. And it was a time when, like, you know, artists were getting kicked out of their housing all over the place. And there was a lot of out-migration from the urban areas of artists to, like, smaller cities. And things were getting fragmented and people were looking for solutions. So they funded them for, like, I think 5 years. And they had an artist space project. And I interviewed to run that. And so...
What's the relationship you draw between the arts and the systems that control your life?
Well, the systems that control my life don't care much about the arts. And so I thought, it was important to try to preserve. I think artists in the city, I think there's a, you know, there are reasons that certain times are more fertile for the arts. And one of those reasons is that you can all be together in these, like, culturally diverse spaces. And if you can't afford to be together, then you lose something fundamental about the arts in your culture and community. And it was a time when a lot of people were getting pushed out, and now they're out, and kind of the decisions have been made and the wars have been lost. But at the time, I think there was still a chance to, like, make a big difference if people had pushed really hard. But I don't think they were able to get a wave around them. I think Art Space in Minneapolis has done good work, but it's really, like, you know, one project is like 5 years, and you can't really get the momentum you need to get the numbers you need.
Feeling just a lot of not pessimism from, but just, yeah, I feel like where you're coming from is a place that things are bad right now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, everything is falling apart.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. But I feel like you're someone with a really unique and just sort of stepped back perspective. Like, if you're talking about entropy controlling all of us, you're the type of person I expect to come in hot with the things are actually, you know, in the long run, things are going to be fine.
Like, no, that's one of the biases that people have. Those people that are always like, don't worry about it. They stick out like a sore thumb to me as being wrong, generally. I mean, the people thought the economy is great, right? We saw this credit bubble building and building and building. And you could look and see that, right? It's on the charts. Like, oh, look, credit bubble. Mm-hmm. Everything's different now. That's always the refrain, right? Everything's different now. And so... You go through enough cycles that you realize it's not.
Did you have this same feeling back when 9/11 happened? Like, did you feel then like things were worse than ever? Have you progressively your whole life?
I actually didn't think that 9/11 wasn't a huge turning point for me and my pessimism.
Not the reaction of legislators after it?
Oh, yeah. Like the way the culture changed.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you meant to, like, some feeling of, like, being under that terrorism was going to go.
No, I mean,
okay.
What you were observing around you in the wake of it.
I don't know. It's hard to put myself back in that time quite that way.
No pressure. Yeah. Let's talk more about decisions. So, How did this new job go? Also, where did it take you? Is that when you moved?
That's when I moved to the city.
Okay.
Took me around the country. I met a bunch of interesting people. Shout out to one of the most interesting was the woman who's now running for Senate in Arizona, Kirsten Sinema.
Wow.
Who wrote a book, who you should read it. So you can read it in a weekend. It's great. It's about working with people who you don't agree with. By matching your values to theirs and finding those spaces and ignoring the other ones and getting shit done.
Great plug. Great advice. Thanks.
But yeah, I did. It was the first time, I think, you know, people have been doing that for a while now, but the kind of progressive community in America was just starting to push this kind of, we all need a unified agenda and we all need to work together sort of thing. We're too fragmented. And working with state legislators is great because, you know, the ones we're working with are the ones who are super committed and they're working with this other organization and flying around the country to meet their peers, to talk strategy and to share resources, and you know, they're the real stars. Being around those people is great, you know, obviously. So, but it's also tiring. You know, you're like, it's kind of like journalism or like a lot of those jobs where you're just kind of like in that on the treadmill all the time.
Travel heavy lifestyle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Lots of deadlines.
Was that the burnout? Was burnout the end of this story?
Oh no, I would have done that more. I would have kept on that path probably through inertia. I didn't like the people I was working for. Everyone was kind of miserable. And at the time, that was definitely the next major inflection point, was figuring out after that whether I was going to, you know, try to get some other job working on elections policy or criminal justice reform, or whether I was going to try to break out of the box.
This is sort of the opposite of your decision one, where you weren't in the best iteration of what you wanted to do, right? Like, you didn't like the people you were working for. You probably could have found something slightly more comfortable.
Yeah. That was definitely an option, but there were still small fields at the time, and I knew most of the people who were involved. And this was during the financial crisis, and wallets were snapping shut. And so the people were losing their jobs and not building out programs. And it was kind of musical chairs with the jobs. And so that was a part of it for sure. And then I also looked at, you know, the kind of possibility topography of my future. And I was getting a level of expertise in the work I was doing where it would have been very hard to do a lateral jump after my next job. Because I would have been running something, I would have had people under me, and the idea would either be to just hold on or to keep climbing that ladder. But people would be kind of weirded out if I was like, actually, I'm just going to bail on that. They'd think I'm having a life crisis or something. And I was like, okay, this might be my last chance to move laterally if I don't.
And you said you weren't playing a chess game. That sounds highly chess-like to me. You were like three steps ahead. You were like, in one step, I won't be able to move diagonal because that king's there. Like, right.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I think a chess is like more than three steps. I think three steps is normal.
Maybe I'm dumb. Chess. I'm just a bad chess player. Okay. So you're thinking a couple steps ahead, which is what we talked about. You're clearing the headspace to envision possible outcomes.
Yeah. So I'm not going to do politics myself. And
why?
Oh, I don't want to. I mean, I've always been the guy who would rather write the speech than give it. Anyway, but so either I was going to go up or I was going to go out, and but not with the same organization, but up in the same field. And I was just not old enough to like feel like that was a good thing to do. And I hadn't done, you know, I had been at the Civil Liberties Union for a long time, you know, 7 years I was there. And so I just thought about, what's my skill set and where does it transfer? And who do I know and where can I get work, you know, potentially? So I figured what I'm good at is doing research and making a pitch, right? Like, that's what I've been doing in different contexts, and both, you know, subject matter contexts and medium contexts and all those sort of variations. And so I figured I could be a good fundraiser. And the other thing is, you know, I only want to work on things that I really care about. Or if it's just like, you know, a job to make money, that's fine. But I don't want something in between, right? Like, something I don't kind of care about, but I really am
have
supposed
to care
about.
Yeah.
I don't
so how
that
does
place.
Fundraising accomplish that goal? That actually feels like something that, is it by virtue of the fact that you can pick and choose what you're going to fundraise for?
Yeah. That it was easy to do kind of freelance work. And that, well, more in the sense that, like, I was looking at the time, and if you look at the nonprofit job ads, like 50% fundraising. I was like, okay, well, if I'm a fundraiser, I kind of have my pick, comparatively. Hmm. And so I went from really narrow to something where I figured, and I can kind of read up on the topic. Because I'm good at that. At the Civil Liberties Union, we worked on insane numbers of topics. Like, you can write a law about dog walking that violates people's rights because it's, you know, vague and overbroad. And so we would just have to quickly get up to speed on stuff.
Constantly. On dog walking. Just learn everything there is to know.
Or like computer crime stuff. Yeah. You know, you think computer crime wouldn't be a like big civil liberties issue, but if you write the law the wrong way, it is.
Okay, I have two questions. You can pick the order.
Okay.
Did you consider political fundraising, or it was that part of it?
No.
I'm curious why, but I also want to know, at that junction, what else was there? Anything else you were considering? Were there any roads untaken worth talking about now?
I don't think so. It was just the kind of bifurcation. I mean, yeah. I still wanted to do...
It's so funny
still how pretty we, bought in to doing nonprofit work and social change stuff.
Gotcha. We didn't want to loop back to biology?
No. It's like something maybe I'll do in my retirement. Every once in a while I read articles. I keep up on some interesting news.
I think it's important to have a retirement career plan. why not political fundraising?
I never was super interested in politics as an endeavor. You know, I'm only interested in it as it impacts life. I don't want to pitch people's brands. You know, that's not what I'm good at. Hmm. I'm good at saying, here's all the information. Here's why it means this. And you should do X, Y, and Z. I've done that a lot. I'm really good at it. I'm not good at like, I don't like, you know, I prefer if I have my druthers to be addressing expert audiences.
Interesting. How does that go? The fundraising life.
The fundraising life goes well. Partially in that I raise a bunch of money, and partially in that it puts me in touch with a lot of people who are interesting. And if somebody's starting a thing, a nonprofit, social enterprise type thing, and they need help or advice, if you've done successful fundraising, then generally they're like excited to hear from you. So again, it's one of those things that gives you a lot of options, like I said. And so, yeah, I raised a bunch of money for things that I think are cool, and it ended up putting me in touch or giving me the ability to kind of offer my services and have them generally accepted to people that I thought were doing the coolest work.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot lately about just what buys you access to a space or a community or whatever, and being really skilled at making them money is probably the number one. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Anytime you want access to a new community, you sort of have to offer something, even if it's a social community. It's like, here's what I can bring you.
Yeah.
Which is kind of capitalist. It's I don't know. It's like kind of upsetting, but it's also the basis of communal living.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I like to think that communities will accept me just because I'm me. Colton, our mutual friend.
That's called dead weight.
Colton, shout out Colton, said the most wonderful thing to me a few days ago. Like, eventually you start making a living just by being your exact self, just by being yourself. Like, you move away from selling a skill for wages to selling you as a person. And that's your peak career moment.
Yeah. I've had those, but it doesn't persist.
Even still.
Even still.
So what happens next?
So I end up through a friend of a friend getting hooked up with people who are starting a new thing in San Francisco. And it's like completely random. Somebody here on holiday for like July 4th was an old friend of my housemate who I didn't know before he moved in, sort of thing. And they were starting this thing called Code for America. And she described it to him, and his response to her was, you know, you got to talk to a Christian because he's like the only person I know who's into like politics and technology and how they might converge. And so he put us in touch, and she was the founding government relations director for that organization. And they, at the time, they're kind of a big shop now that does a bunch of things. But at the time, they started with a fellowship for coders and designers who would spend 9 months in like 3 to 5 person innovation teams in local governments around the country. And so I heard about this and I thought, you know, this is actually interesting. and they might actually be able to do something really cool. And so I basically just offered my services to them. And I was like floating at the time. I had left the other job. And like I said before, they were like, what can you do? And I said, actually, I can do all these things. But they were like, can you help us raise money? Yeah, sure. And so I built out their fundraising program, and I also helped them. I did a kind of like general consulting with them early on, because they were a bunch of technology people who hadn't worked in the government reform space at all. And they had a really cool idea and a really cool program concept, but they didn't really have a theory of change, and they had a rhetoric around what they were doing that was not appealing to government reform people or people who understood how government worked. Though it wasn't really what they were trying to do. A lot of early nonprofits, I think, do this. They have a kind of rhetoric that is a mismatch with their actual mission and tactics.
Because they're like pandering to government people?
No, because they've absorbed it from somewhere and they're not really thinking about it deeply.
Want to give us like a quick, like what's the big misstep?
Well, there was no like one huge thing, but, you know, when you're bringing ideas from the private sector in the corporate world, in some sense, into government, you're, you know, part of a long history of people who have done such and who generally come in not understanding government very well and oversimplifying things and not being very successful. And they weren't really seeing their rhetoric against that backdrop of, you know, somebody who's knowledgeable, who's on the government reform side, you know, has seen this happen again and again. They know this history. They know the tendencies. They know the blind spots of actually people who kind of come in these waves to do this work. And so you have to create a set of messages that's, you know, savvy about that.
Interesting. Pivoting here, is this the way that you start writing code?
Yeah.
How? It's not intuitive. What happens next?
So I'm working with all these designers and developers, and the fellowship was, and probably still is, interesting in that they're trying to kind of get those two groups of people up to speed on the other side's work in short order when they start out. So they have a kind of boot camp sort of arrangement. But because what they do is pretty unique, and they're in San Francisco, and there's not a lot of like code for good organizations, and especially at the time there wasn't. So this would have been like early 2010s. A lot of, you know, really important people swing by to say hi and tell you about their life, and a lot of really top shops will do workshops with you and stuff like that. And because I was always a consultant, I had control over my own schedule and I could participate in all these things. And so I was absorbing all that and then just being there at that time in the startup community, seeing how it worked, seeing the work that people were doing. I studied biology. I was a geek. I've always been interested in science and wanted to learn to code. And I thought, well, now's the time. I'm around all these people that can help me, and I could probably get work if I did it. And so I basically weaned myself from the work I was doing for the organization and used their space all the time, and spent about 18 months teaching myself to code.
And that's now your main source of income. That's like your thing. That's feels like your destiny. Just hearing your story, like you were never not going to become a coder.
It's his destiny.
That's the music of the universe. Yeah. We're singing. We're singing on Radio Free Brooklyn. Amazing. Well, we're almost out of time. Is there anything else about your story that you really want to impart?
Well, now I'm doing a little bit of a crazy thing, which is that a lot of intense things are happening in my life and taking my attention, but I kind of racked my brain the other day and was like, do you have one idea that you could flesh out in like 2 to 4 weeks and like really see if it would get any traction? And just go for it right now. And I did that and I thought of something. So I'm kind of in the middle of that.
You're doing a personal
sprint. A little masochistic, but we'll see how it goes. It should
be done. Do you want to plug it? Is there anywhere we can look for it in the future?
In the future, it will be called Better the News.
Better the News.
Yeah. betterthenews.com, which is just like a blank WordPress page, which would be depressing if you go there right now. But there's lots of work happening.
In 2 to 4 weeks,
listeners,
go to betterthenews.com and find what surprise is waiting for you.
Exactly.
Very cool. Well, thank you. This was like, we went so many places that this doesn't normally go. I've never said the word entropy on this show before.
It's time to bring it back, you know.
What
was good in the 80s.
We really have like a minute and a half of this, but what motivated you to undergo that exercise that you just described?
The
sprint, like how can I make something soon?
The fact that if I get another job, it's going to be a while before I can. And I don't know, it's just like a thing. It kind of worked, you know, people talk about everything was crap and then I just threw it all on the line and did this thing. Not really throwing anything on the line. So it was easy, but it played with that narrative where maybe it'll just work and then I'll be getting a good income off it. And then I can like use that to zoom away from some of the bullshit in my life.
We're zooming away from the bullshit. Wow. Okay. We're going to zoom away from the bullshit together now. Thank you so much for listening. Radio Free Brooklyn is a nonprofit. Your donations to us are tax deductible. Go to the website, radiofreebrooklyn.com, to donate if you are so inclined.
Theme
song, which we haven't been able to get together today, is by Nation of Language. Check them out, even though you didn't hear them today, wherever you get your music. If you're interested in the show, have a crazy life path you want to talk to me about on it, email me, asha@radiofreebrooklyn.org. Find the show on Facebook and please subscribe to me on the Apple Podcast Store. I want you there.